are now plugged in to the Delphi podcast.
Hey everyone, welcome back to the podcast. I'm your host, Tommy, and today I'm joined by Chris Bernitsky, who is a partner at Placeholder, a venture capital firm that invests in decentralized protocols and Web3 services. They are extremely well known. They've invested in over 70 early stage companies, everything from 0x to MakerDAO to ZK Sync. They're extremely thoughtful. They've been around a long time, and Chris has some of the most thoughtful, in-depth pieces that are both timeless and well out of their time. Chris, how's it going?
I'm great. Thanks for the intro, Tommy, and thanks for having me.
Yeah, I have a ton of respect for you, Chris, given you're one of the few people that were open to reviewing an early Delphi post way back when, and I really appreciate you doing that. So I'm excited to have you on.
I remember that. One of the fun things about having been in this industry for a long time is there's a lot of people like yourself that have built, you know, impressive, incredible institutions. And I kind of feel like I've gotten to see all these lifetimes, you know, and everyone's still like in a, we're all still pretty young in our careers. But it's just cool to see these things be birthed and then, you know, hit a significant stage of maturity.
Yeah, no, it's a smaller world than I would have thought, despite the growth in the ecosystem. It seems like it's the same faces every now and then, or just a connection apart.
Totally. Well, and you hear about this too with some Web2, you know, giants where, you know, the early stages of the internet were also very small. And when you're in a movement early, you just get to know everyone. And then all those people become heads of state in a way that you don't anticipate at the time, but is a very cool experience later.
Yeah, no, it really is. I mean, that kind of dovetails well into like one of our first questions, right? Which is lessons learned, you know, over your life in crypto and over Placeholder, the firm's life in crypto. I mean, there's a lot of questions we can ask here, right? I'm not sure where we should start. Maybe we'll start with liquidity, which is a point you brought up on the pre-call.
Totally. Well, and liquidity is kind of an interesting place to start because it's really the end of the venture investor's journey. And, you know, probably a theme of this call will be how crypto venture is different from traditional venture. And so, you know, when you think about traditional venture, often you're making investments into, you know, illiquid names, which is the same as crypto venture at the start. But then with traditional venture, you don't really get the choice of when to sell, at least not with nearly as much granularity and frequency as you do in crypto venture. Because often in traditional venture, you're making a private investment, you're going through multiple equity follow-on rounds. And then, you know, a liquidity event in that context is, you know, often a buyout or in a best case scenario, the company going public. And then when the company goes public, you do get granularity over when you can choose to sell. Many VCs will liquidate, traditional VCs will liquidate a full position when it goes public. There is some variance there, but it's so much less common in traditional venture to have a company going public in that way than it is as a crypto venture investor to have a crypto asset going public, right? And so a crypto venture investor, I think, is really best off having part of the team develop expertise in the public markets to really, you know, understand and harness the full liquidity profile of venture investing in crypto, where you go from a private beginning to a public market ending, and you need to navigate that whole lifespan of the investment.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting dynamic, right? Like as a TLDR, as venture investors in crypto, we get liquidity much earlier than traditional funds. But to your point, liquidity constraints really play into that, right? Our ability to recycle that capital, you know, many times faster than a traditional fund is kind of ridiculous. But one of the bottlenecks there is like the ability to sell, right? Like that team relationship, that, you know, killing the price. How do you navigate that?
Well, there's also a lot here because I've had some traditional venture investors tell me that the inability to sell is more of a feature than a bug. And the reason for that is, you know, okay, you can be up 10x on something and you can take profits on it and you can feel really smart. But if the thing goes 100x, you know, so it goes 10x from when you sold, let's say you made, you know, a $1 million investment, it means that you took profits worth $10 million, but you forewent $90 million of extra profits, right? And so there is a double-edged sword to this, right, of selling too early when you get liquidity. I would say that the way that we navigated it at Placeholder really comes from, say, the genesis of Placeholder being, you know, Joel, myself, and Brad. Joel and Brad coming from pure venture background and myself coming from public market background under Kathy Wood. And the way that we approach it is we're thinking about everything through a venture lens. And a venture lens is, you know, venture multiples where you're hunting for multiples. You're not hunting for percentages in your gains. And then, you know, every investment is scaled to a size where it's material if you get your anticipated multiples. And then, you know, once you do have liquidity, it becomes a question of has the thesis played out sufficiently? So, you know, that's a key one for, you know, choosing to take liquidity. Like, has our anticipated thesis really played out? And then there are a lot of asset-specific questions. You know, there's this trope on crypto Twitter of the evil VCs dumping indiscriminately, you know, the first chance they get. And as with many tropes on crypto Twitter, there's like a shred of truth, but it's mostly mistaken, at least in how Placeholder operates. Because especially for teams where we have led the seed and structured, you know, the whole journey, you know, we're a very material actor in that network. And the last thing we want to be doing is, you know, being detrimental to that network's success and future growth. So there's vesting considerations. There's even just like the liquidity that specific crypto asset has. And what I mean by that is like, typically you don't want to be more than 10% of daily volume if you are choosing to sell. And like, there's also all the interpersonal dynamics, right? And there are firms, I would say, who have developed, let's just say, a bit of a sharkier reputation for taking profits in a bit of a vicious way against an asset that really couldn't handle it. And that doesn't sit well with the founder, right? Because that makes the founder's life harder. That hurts all the stakeholders of the network. And so I would say that, you know, Placeholder is always in close alliance with the entrepreneurs that we support. And our goal is really to be indiscernible when we choose to take liquidity. Like, if no one knows that I took liquidity, then I did a good job in navigating my exit. And of course, you know, in something like ETH or SOL, those are a lot more liquid, or even Bitcoin, right? Those are a lot more liquid than when you lead, you know, the seed into the Series A of a smaller, more application-specific crypto network.
I loved your comment about the traditional VCs being what I guess we could imagine is the real diamond hand investors.
Yeah.
Right? Like they can't sell.
The forced diamond hand.
They are. So I was going to ask you, what is the perfect way to exit a position? And you sort of answered that already, right? With, you know, not being able to be noticed on your exit. I guess a different question for you up this alley, though, is within the portfolio, there are projects which require a lot of time, right? And you may have, you know, not 100% of the position. Maybe it's lower than it started. Maybe it's higher. You decide to go back in, what have you. Is there, I mean, nothing's perfect, right? Is there a ranking system in the time and effort you put in to help these porcos? Like, who gets the hour call? Who gets the half hour call? Like, obviously you want to help everyone, right? But
yeah,
there has to be some sort of system on where you are helpful.
Yeah. Well, it really varies. And, you know, I would say that in capital, Placeholder is pretty balanced in allocating between public crypto assets and private venture deals. But in number, we're overwhelmingly venture deals dominant and time dominant, right? So venture deals get the majority of time, and that is the agreement, right? When you're working with an entrepreneur, at least in the way that Placeholder presents itself to the market of entrepreneurs. I would say, though, that, and I'm going to just speak for myself personally here, and I have two wonderful partners in Joel and Brad, but I've come to think of myself as being most useful to an entrepreneur really at the seed and Series A stage. And, you know, this is where Placeholder is friend and ally to the entrepreneur, and we do work to share the playbook of venture investing so that they can understand, the VC perspective too. And the reason that's important is it prevents them from getting hoodwinked by certain VCs or private investors that might be thinking more exclusively about their financial return than the health of the overall company or network. And so that process of education is really important, especially the younger the entrepreneur is. And then there's just all kinds of like early setup things around like, you know, the pace of hiring, the pace of growth, the discipline of spending, the resisting the temptation to raise the really big round at the high valuation, even if you can, because even though it might look like a temporary success, it's ultimately often to the team or network's detriment. And so going through all those like really early formative questions and debates is generally the work I most enjoy. And then often teams will graduate out of that. For example, Placeholder was led the structuring, the original structuring of Balancer or Uma or ZK Sync Era, and the list goes on. But at least with those earlier names, you know, Balancer and Uma are now public crypto assets. They have independent communities with, you know, a form of governance that works for them. It's not overly reliant or really reliant at all anymore on VCs. And so in a way, I'm still, you know, close friends with Hart and Fernando and different members of those teams, but they've really in a way like graduated to being friends. And I'm still there and I still take, you know, the phone calls when they reach out, but it's not on a regular cadence the way that, you know, the younger teams that I'm working with, and when I say younger, I mean younger in stage, those need a lot of time and effort. Maybe the analogy to use here is it's kind of like when you're growing a tree. When you plant a tree, you need to water it regularly, at least the first year or two, and really like make sure that it survives that period. And then, you know, years 3, 4, 5, that tree really starts to spread its roots, broaden its base of support, right? And then, you know, it becomes much harder to kill, right? Or maybe better framed as it really starts to thrive, whether you water it or not. And so that's often the journey that I end up going through with teams.
It's awesome color. And I mean, you get a lot of leverage on those more mature relationship calls, right? Like they don't have to be like 5-hour structuring calls, but they can just be like larger game theory type approach as to how you can help a team.
Totally. It starts to become a lot more of a strategy. Like I find people either want to talk about like how we're like, you know, if I'm thinking about a conversation with Hart, right? Hart and I are going to talk about like different ecosystems, you know, like Ethereum or Solana or Cosmos and the things that we're seeing there. Like one of the benefits of being a VC is in a way people talk about the ivory tower, which in some ways is true. If you're in an ivory tower and it has more elevation than most other people, you have the perspective of the full landscape. And that's a real privilege. And I think that can be quite helpful to entrepreneurs just to share like, hey, this is roughly what I'm seeing, you know, with the most zoomed out perspective. So it becomes a lot of that. A fair number of macro conversations. I think just, you know, entrepreneurs have to navigate fundraising. And fundraising is always somewhat influenced by how, you know, easy money is flowing, and how easy money is flowing is determined by macro factors outside of our control. And then there's all the personal stuff, which I love too, you know, and which pretty much never hits Twitter or even conversations like this. And it's, you know, hey, Hart, how are you doing? And we go deep into different things that, you know, we're both personally facing that comes from true friendship, right? And so those types of things are a real joy.
Yeah, I think the cool thing that you've been able to do is to build real relationships with the founders where you kind of, it sounds like you're pretty much past that armor of, you know, let me tell my investor all the good things and let me hide all the bad things. It sounds like you're getting, you know, the bad things, which is where you can be most helpful. And it sounds like you're getting that information because you have like a strong personal like connection or relationship with the founders, which I think is really important.
Yeah, that's well said. And thank you, Tommy. It's, I think one of Joel and I's favorite compliments that we got from an entrepreneur is we love having Placeholder on the cap table because you can tell them anything and they won't freak out. And I think that's important for entrepreneurs. There are a lot of fires, a lot of shit storms, a lot of potential reasons to freak out. But when you're in a, you know, disaster situation, you know, high stakes situation, the last thing you want is someone losing their cool, right? You got to have some people in your corner that are going to help you problem solve, and staying calm, cool, collected, I firmly believe does lead to the best problem solving. And we're always there for that.
So how do you replicate that? Like, is it that you focus on like fewer deals and deeper relationships? Is it that you take your time? Like how do I replicate that if I were on the outside?
Sure. Well, you know, if you look at Placeholder, we're tiny in terms of our employee size. We're six people. We're in the midst of hiring a seventh, so an analyst to finally replace Alex Evans, who's now a GP at Bain Crypto and was an analyst with us for a while. But we've just kept the team really small. I think that people are always a little shocked when they hear how small we are. And I think that's important because at least for the way that we approach entrepreneurs is it's very much relationship first. And so we do not claim to be, you know, the end-all be-all VC, right? We don't have a marketing department. We don't have a hiring department. We don't have a data analytics department. We don't have this full suite of services that we can just roll out and, you know, offer to entrepreneurs. Instead, what we offer is close partnership, really with the partner who leads the deal. And so that can be myself, Joel, or Brad. And then, you know, access to the broader team, certainly. But it does all originate from that close partnership with the partner who leads the deal. And in order for the partner to have the time, to truly have the time to commit to the entrepreneur, it means that the partner can't be managing a massive team themselves, right? Because that operational workload really compounds. And you can end up, you know, dealing with a lot more internal problems that consume tons of time that then decreases your ability to work directly with the entrepreneurs. And so often what happens in that scenario is the partner ends up delegating a lot of work to junior partners or analysts or associates or whatever it might be. So that's a really key one. You mentioned one, which is just limiting the number of deals that we do. Like, I remember there was a rumor in 2021 that, you know, we had retired because we were so inactive as an investor in 2021. I mean, we did things like Celestia and Alio and some other things that are working out great for us, but we were very quiet, you know, in 2021 because for us, it just wasn't the right atmosphere to be deploying large amounts of capital. We weren't finding deals for the most part at prices that we found attractive, and everything was moving a little fast, and we weren't able to really take the time to build the relationships that we need to build in order to commit to an entrepreneur and vice versa. And so that was just an example of like a time period where we took a pause, you know, it wasn't like hitting a pause button. It was, we were still, you know, receiving the deal flow, looking at it, having the conversations, the same internal cadence, but just really decreased our pace of investing. And then, you know, on the flip side, you know, we've increased the pace of investing over the last 12 months. But some of that, again, it comes from the climate is allowing us to, you know, I have many teams that I'm committing to right now where I've gotten to know them over the last year, sometimes more. And that's my favorite. Like, I prefer to like meet someone, get to know them, have multiple conversations. And it's not really a formulaic thing. Actually, what happened a lot is I had teams come to me last year trying to raise at too high a valuation. And I just said, hey, you know, we're not going to be able to get there in this market. And then they come back, you know, 8 to 12 months later at evaluations that's more reasonable. And then, you know, we can get there. So those types of situations, again, it's all about the relationship that gets built between the partner and the entrepreneur, at least for the type of boutique venture firm that Placeholder is.
Chris, have there ever been deals where, you know, you missed it because you couldn't move fast enough, right? Like the devil's advocate view of the relationship building side, right? Like
tons.
A lot of funds will find a deal and, right? Like they'll commit within a week or a day. And I've always thought it's insane because you're building, you're getting married to somebody after knowing them for 24 hours. But have you missed any that you actually regret because you were moving slow?
No, I don't think there's any. Let me think. No, I have lots of regrets of deals that I missed, but None jump to mind because I move too slowly.
It's a good answer. Yeah, no, I like that. It's wild how fast some funds move, so it's helpful.
Yeah.
Context.
I would say I struggled with this a lot in 2021, because we faced some pressure about pacing and just like, you know, there was the rumors of retirement, but there's also, you know, just people asking us like, hey, are you guys still in this market or still relevant? And so there's a lot of that type of pressure. And you know, kind of the irony there is that was the wrong pressure to put on us because we were doing the right thing in retrospect. It took a few years. And that's what actually can be so uncomfortable, by the way, about being a long-term investor, is you can look wrong or you can look foolish in the immediacy of things. And it takes years for you to be right. And then when you're right, you're often right in a big way. But I would say that you go through longer durations of being wrong or being perceived as being wrong. And so there's psychological stress there. I would say in terms of like, you know, in the current climate where there's just abundance of good deals at amazing valuations, what I end up doing is I just try and pass really quickly if I'm not personally pulled to do something. And so then I don't burn the cycles. And also like the emotional duress of like really getting to know someone. And then like it's the more you get to know someone, the harder the pass is, at least for me, because then I want to take more care in how I pass and explain it to them and help them. And that all just chews hours, you know? And so the more you go down that path and ultimately pass, the more it exhausts you versus often what I'll do is like, if I get a deal, let's say I get a deal within Solana where I'm mostly focused as a venture investor currently. I'm still doing Ethereum stuff, but Solana's just been the focus for the last 12 to 18 months. If I get a Solana deal on something that I'm not personally interested in, I'll often respond to the person that's offering it to me of, hey, I'm unlikely to do this, but I'm happy to get to know the team and have it be a free-flowing, you know, conversation if they're open to that. If they'd prefer to focus exclusively on fundraising, totally get that too, you know, no hard feelings. And so then it just sets the context of like, hey, this is like, let's get to know each other. You know, I'm committed to this ecosystem. I want to learn about it. I want to know who all the players are. But it's likely just going to be a 30-minute to 45-minute call. And, you know, I'll be useful if I can be useful. And sometimes those conversations turn into them just asking me a bunch of questions or like sharing with me, you know, their current, you know, term sheets that they have or, you know, what they're thinking and me being able to, you know, be an open book and give them feedback on what I think's market or, you know, fair or unfair. And so that's often how I go about it. And that feels good and generative because it feels like I'm getting to know them. I'm being of use to them, but it's not sucking their time or my time in a way that's unproductive. And so that's really how I'll go through a lot of things. And then, you know, it's really like making sure that if I'm going to go deep on something that I have, like I'll check in with my partnership and my team of like alignment there. Hey, how interested are we? You know, I'm a few calls in here before I do more and start getting references and like, you know, doing the deep dive. I just want to make sure everyone's pretty keen here. And you know, I'm really only ever running max two of those processes simultaneously, and that would be max. And then other times I'm not running that process, right? And I have nothing that I'm actively working on. I would say as a last thing, Joel and Brad are really amazing to learn from as venture investors. And, you know, Joel started at USV and helped Brad and Fred formulate their crypto theses. And, you know, Brad co-founded Unisquare Ventures with Fred Wilson in the early 2000s and has almost 40-year venture career. And both of them, I would say, have taught me how to be a more patient venture investor because being more public markets in my training, public markets is like a lot more like daily active work action. Like it's very active and action oriented being in the public markets. And I think to be a really good venture investor, you want to not force things. And you want to really like let things come to you when they're like, in a way, almost like screamingly obvious to you, even if they're not obvious to other people. And that just requires like being comfortable not doing anything. And just to wrap this up, you can still be useful to your existing portfolio in that process or to teams in an ecosystem that you're interested in, even if you're not actively diligencing deals.
Now, that's a great answer. It is kind of funny, like zooming out, you have to be like contrarian, which is there's a lot of friction through that process. And you also have to be okay going through the motions day after day for years until you find like the couple of plays that you like. It's definitely a skill that's a patient skill to develop.
Yeah. And if you're good, if you're really good, you find 1 to 2 a year.
That's just crazy to think of. I know you're right. It's just, you know, to think of finding one at Christmas and then one in the summer is just, it seems like we're not working hard enough, but the reality is you are.
Right. Well, and I mean, sometimes I think about venture as being, it's not arduous, but it is difficult because the tendency is to do too much and make a bunch of mistakes that you can't recover from. And this also applies to long-term public market investing, specifically in crypto, where like the dominant mistake most retail investors in crypto make is they trade too much. They're too active. This doesn't originate from me, but a phrase that came to me early on in my Bitcoin career was, Bitcoin's like soap. The more you touch it, the less you have. And I feel like that just almost universally applies to people who are hyperactive with their crypto asset investing action. Whereas like you could take 2 actions every 4 years and do phenomenally well as a retail investor in crypto. In reality, you probably need to tranche out your buys and tranche out your sells like in earnest, you know, if you want to be like more strategic and concerted about it. But it's basically like you buy 1 year and 3 to 5 years later you sell, and then you wait 18 months. And then you buy that year, and then 3 to 5 years later, you sell. Like if you just want to be like a harvesting machine. And that's very little action. So it's not arduous, but it is difficult.
Yeah, no, it is. It's a similar skill to the VC side. But just to switch gears, Chris, I want to go into the strategy of the firm, right? You guys were, you know, very focused on Ethereum early on, then Solana, right? Let's talk a bit about that transition, right? Because I think a lot of people know Chris Bernitsky as kind of the Ethereum guy, right?
Mm-hmm. Totally. Well, there's a lot there. So let's start with maybe placeholder, and then we can get into like BTC, ETH, SOL, which I would say are like have been the defining ecosystems of placeholder. So, you know, if we go back to when Joel and I were getting to know each other, Ethereum had just launched as a network. It was a new thing. Like I remember, you know, this meetup in New York City where like the ERC-20 standard was being presented as like a future thing, right? And it's like, oh, cool. Like tokens are going to get easy to launch. Like what's going to happen now? Oh, there's probably going to be a lot of tokens. And like Joel and I going through that exploration together, you know, at a time when there were basically 3 analysts on all of Wall Street that knew anything about crypto. It was me on the buy side at ARK. It was Gil Luria at Wedbush, publishing sell-side research at the time, and Spencer Bogart, who was at Needham and is now a director of research at Blockchain Capital. So like on the public market side, or like Wall Street side, there were 3 of us in all of New York City, at least of like any note. And then on the venture side, it was really just Joel that I knew in New York City. There was like Jake Brookman had like CoinFund running, and I remember CoinFund had this very early website of like, you know, there weren't that many tokens at the time. And so like, you know, it was kind of fascinating to be like, oh, there could be like a fund of tokens. Like, that's cool. And that was, even at that time, that was a new idea. And then really where I'm going with all of this is Joel and I just started to learn a ton from each other because I had like, venture was a black box to me. I only saw the stuff once it went liquid and I mostly focused on Bitcoin for Kathy, and that all panned out, you know, really well for ARK and Kathy. And then, you know, Joel, you know, he would look at like the public market stuff and like there's all these wiggly lines and this chaos and it's like, why is this thing down 40% this day and up 20% the next day, right? And it's just as confusing. right? So we really started to teach each other about the other's side of the market. And Brad came into that picture, and I got to know the whole USD team, and Joel got to know Kathy, and that was all really cool. And then the realization Joel and I had is, wow, like investing in crypto, even at the private stage, requires the melding of private and public market expertise, because often your lifestyle or your life cycle of an investment goes from venture to public markets. And so that's really the wedding of ARK Invest and Union Square Ventures, or myself and Joel. And so that's really the genesis of Placeholder. And then, you know, we always have been a venture capital firm and are structured in that way. And so we are very venture minded, but I think over time, people realize more and more that we do have public market expertise. So I just start there. And then, you know, the original core thesis and the thesis summary is available on our website for anyone who wants to read it. But we basically looked at the history of information technology as going through these different eras where a different resource within information technology was the golden goose. And then that resource would get unlocked by an open standard. And so it's like, okay, what do I mean about that to make it practical? The resource that everything started with was hardware, you know, just the bare metal of actually standing up the compute power to be able to power information technology systems. And so you're really going through hardware in the 40s and 50s and 60s, and, you know, famously consolidates around IBM. But it's a microprocessor in 1971 that's an open standard for compute that starts to unlock the hardware market, starts to put pressure on IBM, you know, starts to put pressure on those margins. And as you put pressure on those margins, you open up the next layer. And that was really the software layer, which really started to bloom in the 70s and 80s, you know, really consolidates around Microsoft, who can put more CDs on more shelves than anyone else, is building the best proprietary software out there. For, you know, a number of PC manufacturers. But once again, you know, that software market gets attacked by two open standards, really the open standard to share information, which is TCP/IP, and then open source software as a standard form of collaboration. And those two things start to eat into Microsoft's market dominance, right? Put pressure on those margins and really unlocks the next value accrual layer, which was data. And data is really the era that we currently exist in, where the golden goose of Netflix and Amazon and Meta and all these juggernauts of our modern world, you know, their golden goose is proprietary data, and they charge for you know, proprietary access to proprietary data, or provide a proprietary service off of proprietary data. And we really saw blockchains as the open standard to unlock access and coordination around data. And so that's really the kernel of everything that we do. And it's also, you know, it is crystallized into, you know, our mission being to better distribute data, wealth, and power. Wealth and power are just derivatives of data. But, you know, that's really the kernel of how we think about all this. Let me pause there before I go into BTC, ETH, and SOL.
No, this is great, Chris. Please continue. I'd love to hear the transition from BTC to ETH to SOL, like with that thesis in mind, right? Just kind of understanding like the trend from one to the other while still being true to that thesis, I think would be really helpful too.
Cool. Well, yeah, if you go back to both Joel and myself personally before either of us knew each other, Bitcoin is really the thing that drew our fascination because it was the only one, right? And we came at it from different angles, but it captured our attention. So, you know, at that time, like if you go to like 2014, 15 New York City, like there were a bunch of awesome like Bitcoin meetups. Like there was a White Paper Wednesday where like it was basically like every new thing coming out around Bitcoin, you would get to be in a pretty small room, small group of people. But, you know, you would have, you know, like Peter Todd there or Matt Corallo, like Blue Matt, basically Bitcoin core devs, and, you know, a long list of those types of folks that like there was unfettered access to because everything was still so small. I mean, at that time, I think Bitcoin's market cap was like $3 billion. So it was just so, I guess, inconsequential in the grand scheme of things. and didn't attract that much attention. And so what I'm getting at here is, like, for me as a very young analyst, like I'm 24, 25 at that time working for Kathy, and I'm like very impressionable, right? And I'm looking up to all these folks, and I, like, you know, bought the Bitcoin story hook, line, and sinker, or hook, line, and sinker. Anyway, you get what I mean. And like go down the, you know, economic studies of, you know, Keynesian and Austrian economics, and like, and I'm a reader, and I'm a nerd, so I just end up buying lots of books and reading those books to understand the full context around the thing. And so really come to see Bitcoin as the perfect store of value in how its supply is architected, right? And have never had such an extreme force of scarcity. Like, humanity has never had an asset like this that has this type of scarcity and force, because you can only have such extreme scarcity, I would argue, in a physical, like completely in a digital, completely synthetic world where you control all the rules. In nature, like, the rules are outside of your control often, and so you can't limit the supply in this way. You know, companies that require like capital to continue financing themselves, they often, like, you know, have stock issuance, and bonds are a different thing entirely. So anyway, Bitcoin is perfect scarcity. It's, you know, the most conservative technology out there in that it preserves what it is. It's this mirror for society. It reflects liquidity conditions. It's all these like really powerful things for society. And so that was our beginning. And, you know, when Bitcoin was at $3,000, it was a very attractive investment for us. And so, you know, in 2018, 19, we were there, at scale. And at that same period, though, in 18, 19, we also very much have our eye on Ethereum. And you said, hey, isn't like Chris Bernanke like an Ethereum guy? And if I go back in time again, and sorry, I'm jumping temporally a bit, but even though Joel and I cut our teeth first on Bitcoin, I would say we grew up with Ethereum, because we weren't there to watch Bitcoin be born, but we were there as Ethereum was being born. And, you know, and Joel was actually even closer with like the early builders, because he's on the venture side, right? So they're all coming to USV, and I'm kind of more observing this, you know, in the second row, being the public markets guy that I am. But, you know, certainly through 2017, when ICOs went crazy, and, you know, we were just kind of in awe of what was going on with Ethereum. And it was like, it was our home, I guess I would say. And so then in 18-19, when ETH sold off 95%, for us, it, you know, it took us some time to be like, okay, even though we're a venture firm, we should, you know, have a large ETH position, because our thinking was there's so much venture investing to do on top of Ethereum. Like, we should do that work for the LPs. But then what we realized is like that people wanted ETH exposure, right? And we were personally accumulating ETH. So anyway, that's a long way of saying that, you know, also entered ETH in a big way in 18-19, and then did all the venture investing that, you know, we touched upon, of like ZK Sync and Bouncer and Uma and other names that worked out well for us, and that, you know, were phenomenal or continue to be phenomenal in 2021, 22, 23. But then the interesting thing that happens is like Ethereum was once an underdog, right? Just as Bitcoin was once an underdog. And so I went through the journey of Bitcoin going from underdog to, say, king, and then Ethereum. And Bitcoin, by the way, was more of an underdog societally, but you could feel it early on that it was an underdog, and then it's been accepted more broadly now. So 2021 was really, you know, the year of Ethereum's realization, I would say, of its success, and, you know, of people accepting it as a queen of crypto alongside Bitcoin. And then you had a number of, you know, up and comers, very flashy, very fast moving. And, you know, as we descended into the bear market of 2022 and 2023, it became very clear to us that Solana was the most formidable smart contract underdog. And I'll get into that in a second. But it's also fueled by, you know, having gone through a journey of when Bitcoin itself was a underdog societally, right? Like,
people used to laugh at you or used to be like the weird Bitcoin person, or, you know, it was borderline a joke, right? At least when I was getting involved in the industry. And so it rose from that, from being a joke to being a very credible macro asset. And then really when Ethereum came around, it was the underdog to Ethereum. And, you know, I'm sure many Ethereum folks remember kind of how poorly treated we were as, like, you know, the up and comers in the Ethereum ecosystem. And even the 2018-19 bear market, like the ETH BTC ratio got brutalized, right? There was a death of ETH party basically at the bottom of ETH BTC. And so that, of course, all turned around and Ethereum folks were vindicated in 2021 as, you know, ETH put up multiples against BTC. I mean, I basically think of BTC as going 20x from bottom to top into 2021, and ETH went 60x, right? Roughly. And so ETH outperformed BTC by 3x, which, you know, it's no small feat to outperform the best macro asset by 3x when it's, you know, liquid and sufficiently de-risked as we viewed ETH to be at the time. But again, it's like, I guess in our nature, and Joel shared this thing with me recently of, say, something that binds together a lot of good investors is having moved around a lot as kids. And actually, Joel and I both have that. We're both raised internationally, and I actually didn't come to the US until I was six. And so there is kind of this this comfort in being on the move and like exploring the next thing. And it's not that we don't have love and loyalty to Bitcoin and ETH. And I actually just tweeted this out this morning as I was thinking about this podcast of, like, you know, one way that I personally avoid, you know, singular bag bias or maximalist bag bias is I just continue to hold a lot of the things that got me here, you know? And so even if, you know, it seems like this confusing thing of, hey, I thought Chris was an Ethereum guy because he really supported Ethereum in 1819, but now why is he tweeting so much about Solana? Isn't Solana an enemy of ETH? The way I view it is, like, Ethereum in a way doesn't really need me anymore. Like, there's tons of venture investors there. There's tons of capital there. It's a pretty consensus asset. You know, the bankless guys are there producing more media than I could ever dream of. Like, there's just so much there that I don't move the needle for Ethereum the way that I can for an underdog like Solana, right? And so then my hours are higher leverage working with the underdog. And then it's the question becomes, you know, why Solana? And I think that's actually like a pretty painful question for, say, like hardcore Ethereum folks. And the reason I say that is, you know, I've gone through my whole own journey with Solana, where I remember when Joel raised the white paper that totally dropped, I think it was in 2017. And Joel said something like, hey, this Qualcomm engineer, like, dropped this cool white paper. This was right in the white paper era of crypto. And, you know, we're kind of nerding out on it. And it didn't even really occur to us to chase it at that time. And we were actually just standing up Placeholder. Like, Placeholder was born actually the day that Bitcoin forked as a management company. And so anyway, there was that white paper moment. And then, you know, Multicoin got very involved with Solana. And then I think it was 2020 that the Solana network went live. And, you know, remember looking at Solana around a dollar, sub a dollar. And the truth is, like, Placeholder did not make an entry then. We talked about it a lot. I think we thought of ourselves so much as pure play venture investors at the time that we were like, we are committed to Ethereum. Ethereum, we think, is currently best in class in the smart contract category. And so we're all in there. And that worked out phenomenally well for us. You know, I'm happy we did that. But I think that going through the process of Solana, you know, basically 200xing in 2021, it led to a lot of conversation that refined the way that we operate between private and public markets. And I know I'm jumping around a bit here, but it's all interrelated. So, you know, we've come to the realization that, okay, when you're private market investing, you really should not be investing competitively. And I shouldn't even say realization. That's just the way it's always been for us. And that's kind of tried and true venture form. It's like, if I'm a venture investor in ZK Sync and Optimism, and I'm at the board meetings of both, that's a little uncomfortable because I'm getting so much information and directing the strategy of each. And the two are like, you know, have a healthy amount of competition or coopetition between them, right? So that's the private market. So we continue to avoid competitive private market investments. And even if we're considering something that might be competitive, we let entrepreneurs in the existing portfolio know and give them the right to basically, deny that. Because we don't want to make our working relationship with someone we've committed to already uncomfortable. So that's the private side. But on the public side, you know, the interesting thing is you are working a lot less closely with the teams, and the teams are at a more mature stage generally. And so I think of it more as starting to hold complementary positions that really round out overall access to the or exposure to the crypto ecosystem. And so that's really where, like, as we went through investigating Solana, it was like, Solana is the antithesis to Ethereum and Cosmos, right? And there are a lot of benefits that come from that, a lot of trade-offs. And even though I would say that, like, I at times had an allergic reaction in 2021, as such a big ETH bull, right? So I had some allergic reactions to Solana that I had to then go and investigate myself personally. Those reactions really came from a place of feeling threatened, right? That's the base reaction. And that's really what I see in Bitcoin maxis. They get threatened by Ethereum folks, and Ethereum maxis get threatened by Solana folks. And then it comes out sideways when you're saying it publicly because you can't admit your vulnerability and feeling threatened. At least most people can't. But that's really just where it comes from. Now, there are also other, like, very credible concerns around, like, how well distributed is Solana, right? And when FTX was such a big player and Alameda, and when Alameda was, you know, going through a lot of predatory structurings of Solana tokens, like, all of that stuff in 2021, I didn't want to be there, right? I didn't want to be associated. It doesn't really matter to me how much money I'm going to make off of it. It's not it just doesn't feel right to me. It's not who I am. And so our first foray into Solana was actually Orca, leading Orca's deal. Orca's, you know, you could think of it as the Uniswap of Solana, but very equitable token distribution, basically same token distribution model in percentages as Uniswap. And I knew Yutaro from time in Ethereum. He actually used to work at UMA and at the Ethereum Foundation, and, you know, his co-founder Grace, and they're a lovely team. And so it was like, okay, here's a team that I value align with, that wants to do things the right way, that wants to build, you know, something enduring, and you know, fairly benefit all stakeholders. And so that was the first entry, and that was in 2021 into Solana. And then that just started leading to more and more conversations, not just with Yutaro, but with Tolly and Raj and more Solana builders, such that through 2022, as Solana was going through, you know, hardship after hardship, we were basically increasing our conviction on it, right? And then we started making investments and leading deals in Vault, Vault.fan, which is, you know, the team that built FanDuel, which has millions of users and, you know, billions in revenues. That's FanDuel, is now building Bolt.fan on Solana. We led Tensor, which is, you know, now the number one NFT marketplace on Solana. We led Drip. We led Squads. You know, Drip is really experimenting with a free NFT distribution model for list curators, which is maybe the fastest growing app in crypto right now. I mean, it's hard to say exactly, but extremely fast growing app. You know, Squads basically has 100% market share of multi-sigs on Solana, and it doesn't stop there with their aspirations. So there's just a lot of deals that we ended up doing around Solana as we were also accumulating SOL itself, just as we did with ETH and the Ether, the Ethereum ecosystem. And the way that we've come to think of this is it's aircraft carrier strategy. You buy the body of the beast, you invest in the turbines, you really get to know the ecosystem very well over time. And when you go really deep like this, you come to know all the players. And, you know, our pursuit is always to just work with the best team that's pursuing a use case or service or application that we really believe with and align with and want to see in the world. And so that's why we tend to go very deep with a chosen ecosystem, because it just suits us a little bit better than, you know, dabbling a little bit in this ecosystem, that ecosystem, and the other ecosystem. And then to come all the way back to, like, you know, say, what is the merit of Solana? I would say I really like when networks or ecosystems can deduce themselves down to a single word or sentence. So like Bitcoin would probably be like resilience, right? And Ethereum would probably be optimism. And Solana would probably be speed, right? Or performance. And another way you could think of it is Solana is consensus at the speed of light. And there is a almost singular fixation with that, with consensus at the speed of light. And that singular fixation, being the first fixated on that way, drew a lot of people around Tolly and Raj and that core team, right? And so then it attracted a lot of people who value that. And, you know, the independent builders within Solana, if you compare them to, say, the independent builders within Ethereum, I would say they're generally more pragmatic. And Ethereum builders, and, you know, these are admittedly gross overgeneralizations, but Ethereum builders will go for, say, optimism a bit more over pragmatism, or at least ideology. And that's not a bad thing. I want to make that clear because it's important and it's been key to, you know, getting crypto to where it is today. But as crypto itself continues to mature and be relevant to broader sets of society, I think one of my realizations has been like, my set of values is not entirely representative of society's set of values. And if I see net positive values for the world, even if they're not 100% the things that got me into the space, then I should still support them if they're really quality in their pursuit, right? And so, like, I don't think of myself as like a fast person. If anything, I'm kind of slow, plodding, thoughtful, you know, and so speed is not like something that I'm ever like, oh, I'm the speediest person out there. Like, I really align with Solana's pursuit of speed, but it's more that I've come to see the value of consensus at the speed of light, just to look into, you know, entrepreneurs' eyes or souls or whatever and see how important that speed is to them in the experiences they're trying to create. And then basically say, okay, this is really unique and original and earnest in its pursuit, such that it's likely to accrue, you know, long-term value and connectivity.
Chris, you shared so much there that I think is super interesting. I mean, one of the things that I really like is that you guys are, it sounds like that marriage of the capital markets and, or public markets and private between you and Joel is like, you know, it's resonating again, right? With the idea of having that large liquid position in an ecosystem and then investing in the venture deals around them. And I think it's cool too, because like you have this just invisible force where it's like, are the deals we're doing better than holding the underlying asset? And the other thing is, to your point, you get way more involved. But I have a couple of questions for you on the thesis itself. Like, so, you know, you were really involved with Ethereum long term, and you know, you've seen the problems that it's had in the past and the problems that it has now. I mean, there's, you know, so many L2s, it's hard to count. There's a plethora of ZK technology, optimistic technology. You know, you, Joel, and Brad, you could have decided, you know, hey, let's not do Sol. Let's, you know, let's rally around a specific L2, right? Like, that's the new iteration. Like, I don't know, what are the, you know, the thoughts against doing that? What are the problems you're seeing with ETH? I'll throw a couple questions your way so you could take it however you'd like.
Sure. Well, I would say we are there with the L2s, right? We structured ZK Sync's seed and have been there throughout. And, you know, the Alexes are friends, and we continue to be there. Kind of like I said earlier, it's a tree that's, you know, 4, 5, 6 years into its existence. And Andreessen is there, and USV is there, and Dragonfly is there. And, you know, the whole cast of characters in a way is there, such that I would say I'm a little less needed, still always available. But it's in a way outgrown me. That position is going to be a good one for us. And we are actively diligencing public L2s. And, you know, so I would say we're still studying that, right? And like, I'm still investing in the Ethereum ecosystem. And in particular, I'm quite interested right now in ETH NFTs, because I think that, you know, it's probably the sector that's fallen apart the most and is most hated, but that is just so obvious to me. And that will come back in like a really dynamic, interesting way that's a lot healthier than what 2021 NFTs were. So anyway, still there on Ethereum, but I would say that Ethereum has become so consensus that our time and our dollars don't go quite as far there, right? And this is something that I think, you know, everyone hears you want to be contrarian or you want to be non-consensus or whatever, and it's so alluring to be like, oh, I'm contrarian. Whereas in reality, the majority of us trend follow in almost all parts of our life, because trend following is belonging, right? And we all want to belong. And so like I'm a trend follower in parts of my life. In a few rare instances, I'm contrarian. But what I'm getting at here is Ethereum being so consensus puts a lot of weight on its shoulders. And it also leaks into the pricing, where like Ethereum is well priced, right? And you know, it's basically at 2K, you know, ETH is basically 60% off its highs, roughly, right? Whereas Sol sold off 97% off its highs. It's considerably more, say, underpriced. And Sol's had a repricing in the last few weeks, but it's still far beneath where ETH is relative to all-time highs. And when you have that kind of pressure, it's much easier to disappoint expectations, because expectations are so much higher, right? So I would start there, that the expectations are extremely high for ETH. They remain much higher for ETH than they do for Solana. And so then that requires like near perfect execution of a lot of difficult things. And every crypto ecosystem faces a lot of difficult things. Specifically problematic things right now are, I would say, all of the privatized L2s, they're pushing each other forward, but they're also in competition with each other for, you know, users, for liquidity, for market share. And I would say that, you know, their privatized interest supersede, you know, the interest in ETH, right? Or say the overall ecosystem. And it's not that they're malicious, you know, and again, I work with some of these teams. And so, you know, it's not at all a malicious thing. It's just the setup, because there's so much value to be gained by being a dominant L2, especially if it's an L2 like, you know, Arbitrum, where there's like the main chain, or, you know, what might be Optimism super chain, or Eras is going to have this too from ZK Sync, where like it's a major, there's one L2 that's a major hub where apps are, right? And so that kind of privatized competition is difficult, right? And I think it's harder to align. More broadly and kind of easier to piece through, at least in the podcast, is L2s are compression technology. You know, they mean that you need less ETH for the same amount of computation than you did before. Now, the rebuttal to that is L2s expand the bandwidth of ETH. You're going to get higher volume. It ultimately doesn't matter. ETH is powering the next value internet, you know, so on and so forth, like any of the kind of standard Ethereum bull theses. But I'm still not sold that like these being a compression technology is potentially problematic, is maybe too strong of a word, but it needs to be taken into consideration, you know, if you're allocating to ETH here. And I guess where I come out on all of this is like, L2s are a business model innovation. I think there will be the super L2s like ZK Sync Era, you know, but I think there's going to be far more L2s like Base from Coinbase, where there's probably not going to be a crypto asset. You know, it's probably a centralized sequencer. It's a business model for a company. You know, there's a specific application that maintains it. And that's cool. Like, I think that's great. And I think that's additive to Ethereum. And then, you know, wallets have to abstract away the L2 complexity in a manner that isn't irritating to the end user. And that'll happen. Like, we will get there. It'll get done. I think it's just going to take more time than people anticipate. it's all in the works. But I guess if I were to just sum up, it's like Ethereum has really high expectations and a number of sticky problems to still solve. Whereas I look at Solana as having much lower expectations and has solved more of the problems it needs to solve to get to the next leg of growth. And then Solana's going to probably hit problems again. Like, I could see Solana scale failing at the height of the next expansion, or at least like going through some network congestion, right? And Fire Dancer is going to help with this. And, you know, but then Solana will have to go back and reconsider some things and, you know, keep updating itself and keep shipping. And what I would say in summation is, like, I love Bitcoin. I love Ethereum. I love Solana. I think they're all super important. I think they all keep iterating in different ways, and they need to keep iterating to, you know, stay relevant with the times. And that's where a lot of this, if you're a really long-term investor, which Placeholder is, it's almost more of a war of attrition, like the teams that drop out or don't quite make it, than it is like, you know, needing to outspend and out-execute and whatever. You need to just continue staying relevant with enough market share and innovating enough to, you know, fix the problems that arise. And I do think Bitcoin and Ethereum and Solana are all tracking well to do that for decades to come.
I like your view, Chris. It's differentiated because you take like a, I don't know whether it's a game theory or a psychological kind of point of view on the networks themselves. I think one thing that you did in the past was someone on Twitter mentioned, I wish I could give them credit, I just forgot who it was, that, you know, you did a lot of work on network valuation models back in the day, right? And there's this constant debate of like, what's money? Is ETH money? Is SOL money? Like, I don't know. How do you think about SOL value accrual, SOL as money? I know these are kind of flimsy questions, but
yeah,
it becomes important.
Well, I would, this could be an oversimplification, but I would really bucket it into there are growth strategies to value accrual, and there are profitability strategies to value accrual. And starting with the profitability strategies, that's kind of like value investing 101, right? And it's like, what's your free cash flow? What's your yield? What's your PE ratio? Like, what are the fundamentals that a business is priced off of? And this is very much the Warren Buffett, right, style of investing. Where you have real cash flows that support the value of a corporation. And often those cash flows get dividended out, right? And you have a dividend yield that's sizable. Now, that worked quite well in the industrial era, I would say, when things didn't move as quickly and you could capture a large amount of a market and not have to look over your shoulder about getting disrupted in 18 months. And you could just churn out, you know, dividend yield to investors. I would say as the pace of change has increased, you when you're dividending out like that, you're reinvesting in your future less. And that opens you up to attack from people that are going to pursue a growth strategy and just continually keep reinvesting. And so Amazon is really like the categorical example of this within Web2, where, like, you know, I think Amazon went from like $100 to $7 in the .com bust. And Kathy Wood, who I used to work for, has been with Amazon for basically its entire journey, right? And so I learned a lot of this from Kathy, where like Amazon, like people hated it for a period because it wasn't profitable. It was always reinvesting, right? Lots of stock-based comp. And like, if I come to my era of when I was an equities analyst, I remember there was a company, Splunk, that I covered that I quite liked. And I think they just got bought, actually. But Splunk had like 15 to 20% annual stock-based comp dilution on its equity, right? That's like higher rates of annual inflation than like any of the layer one crypto assets, right? And there are some people who would look at that and be like, that's insane. This company needs to grow so fast in order to keep up with that rate of dilution. But really, that was part of getting the best talent for Splunk, right? And part of their resource base that allowed them to ultimately be a good investment, right? And so where I'm going with this is Ethereum is more of a value investor's dream at this point in time, I would say. It's a very cool value investment in that, like, it's profitable and, you know, it's not inflationary anymore. And it's yielding out, you know, ETH in a way that does not dilute holders. And I think that's super cool. And at the same time, you know, if it goes to 10K in the next expansion, it's still got a 5-6x from here. And so, like, how cool that you can have a profitable and, by, you know, any standard outside of crypto, a very, like, you know, high octane asset. And so that's ETH. Sol is really pursuing the growth strategy where it's just, you know, we're going to continue reinvesting in ourselves. There is going to be dilution of the asset base. And I am sympathetic to Tolle's view that with staking in there, staking is just redistribution from non-stakers to stakers. And, you know, you can think of it pretty much as simply as that. And if you're really committed to the network, then you should be staking. And if you're not staking, then, you know, you might have reasons for doing that work for you. And you're still going to probably do well through the growth strategy if it works out. And so that's how I think of Sol. And then what's TBD is, you know, will Sol ever flip into a value strategy, right? And become quote unquote profitable and collect more in Sol fees than it issues new Sol per year. And it has time to figure that out. But I think it's a temporal mistake to say Sol is not going to do well, you know, in the next few years because it's pursuing a growth strategy. Because if you study, you know, even the last 10 to 15 years of tech investing, that's just so not true. Those have largely been your best performing investments, if you're correct with your timing.
I like the comparison of the growth versus the value strategy. I guess, Chris, my thesis on Solana might be a little, you know, lower IQ, but, you know, I loved just the tagline of, you know, the fastest global state machine or fastest exchange, right, at the speed of light. However you frame that the right way, I'm probably messing it up a little bit. But, you know, one of the things that's clear in this bull run is that Solana, it just seems very clean, right? Like, there are coming tech upgrades and we're going to improve. And then on the other side, you have Ethereum, which is, you know, pretty chaotic with all these L2 bridges, DA layers. Like, it's confusing. And Kyle from Multicoins always made the great point that, you know, you want to serve developers. I'm curious, though, to maybe take the other side of that. What would disprove your Solana thesis here? I know you said that eventually they would, you know, potentially run into problems on the next growth run, but, you know, is there anything that would make you say, you know, look, I came into this for the right reasons, but X, Y, and Z are not going well, and, you know, I'm going to scale back a little bit in my efforts?
Well, you know, like, Solana, they were overplayed, but Solana did go through some outages in 22, right? And people claim there were more than there actually were. But I think that, like, state needs to keep getting updated at the cadence that's promised to developers and users, right? And I do think Fire Dancer is a big part of increasing resilience there. That's maybe, like, the, say, an operational risk that's there that I have faith, given the, you know, technical excellence of the Solana team and the Fire Dancer team, that it'll be okay. But that is one. It's still recoverable, like, even if there is a outage of some sort, but you just don't want it to be a regular thing. Now, the most important thing is that, like, the veracity of state is preserved, which it always has been in Solana. And that is certainly the thing that can never be corrupted, because that's basically the core of you know, say, a blockchain innovation is preserving the truth. So there's that. I would say the other things that would come to mind is, like, I believe that these systems need to remain open source and they need to remain auditable by, you know, sophisticated actors. So, like, what I mean by that, and you could just say open source and transparent to keep it simple, but that transparency is, like, the Fed is not, like, I mean, they're pretty transparent, but not as transparent as Bitcoin is and Ethereum is, or as Solana is. Solana is much more transparent than, say, our black box institutions. And so, you know, I know there's a lot of debate around, you know, the, like, a user should be able to verify state. And for what it's worth, we've worked with the Celestia team for a long time. And, Nick White is a good friend, and I think Mustafa is an amazing founder, you know, of the type of Vitalik and Tolly. And I think Celestia has a very bright future. And Celestia would say, like, or Celestia is very focused on, you know, light clients, which is less of a focus for Solana. And so this is where I come to, like, different developers are going to have different value sets and things that they need to get them to build in a place. And I think that you will end up getting execution environments on Celestia and on Ethereum that rival, you know, or are equivalent to the speed of Solana. And so that's all going to happen. But then, you know, I still think Solana is going to have enough critical mass and composability and liquidity to be very relevant for a long time. And so the boring answer, Tommy, is actually, I don't see that much that could invalidate my thesis, because my thesis on it is quite simple at the base of open source, transparent, and consensus at the speed of light with preservation of state. And I think they have all those things. And I don't, like, Tolly and his team are committed to those things.
I love it. It's just such a simple thesis, and it's just so clean, right? It's sort of beautiful when you think about it the right way. But Chris, I want to respect your time, and we're kind of butting up toward the end of the episode here. And I think you just shared just like an insane amount of like personal alpha on Placeholder as a firm and the growth, and then the Solana and ETH thesis. I'd love to ask you though, if we missed anything that you'd want to chat about, or any, you know, last kind of thoughts based on the episode. We have a couple minutes left.
Sure. There's one we have highlighted in our notes that I think is reminding people of as we have gone through a frothy few weeks here. And I should say that for me, like, reading the markets is kind of like my daily crossword puzzle. I just do it because I enjoy it, but I actually don't take nearly as much action as I think people think I take, because I'm very glacial in how I move. And I'm much more like the investor that I tried to describe earlier, that takes a few actions in 1 year and a few actions a few years later. And that's really how I operate. That said, you know, I know some people like to be more active or whatever in how they manage their portfolios. And the thing that I'm building up to saying here is, as I've investigated kind of the psychology of investing in crypto and through myself and other people, I've realized that I think one of the reasons people have a really hard time selling or ever taking profits is because when you sell, you're giving up theoretically unlimited upside, or you're giving up infinite upside in your mind. And the reason I say that is, like, when you're dreaming and you're drunk on profits, you're like, okay, like, you know, I put $1,000 into this and I have $100,000 of it, but now if it goes to $1 million, I'll be a millionaire, you know? And the mind, it's a temptation to think that way. And so I think people really, if they want to be a committed investor in crypto, and it really doesn't matter the scale of dollars you operate at, you can do this well. And that's part of the beauty of crypto, but it's getting really disciplined on, you know, how you enter and how you exit, and recognizing the psychology or the pain of, you know, unlimited upside being forgone. And the way to counteract that pain is to just decide for yourself what is enough, you know. And if you've realized a 10x or a 20x, if you're really lucky, a 50x or 100x, like, that's, for a lot of people, that's more than enough. So that's a key thing, you know, being disciplined on entry, which really requires preserving capital and having taken profits in frothy times. And when I say preserving capital, I mean having a tranche in plan, so bullets at different price targets. And you can have, you know, a tranche out plan. You can have bullets at different price targets to the upside. And so it really is about the science of investing. And I think it's achievable for everyone. But to really get into the science of investing, you have to first get control of your emotions.
Yeah, I'm with you there. It's incredible. It's just, Tyler Reynolds is a close friend, and he always told me, like, one of the key things, just not to blow up, right? Like, pay your taxes.
Yeah.
Don't do anything stupid. Don't use leverage. And like, that's just staying in the game long enough to make money.
Yeah. Do less. Make more.
Yeah. Chris, I really, really appreciate you coming on. I can't wait to share the episode, and I appreciate your time. It's just like a masterclass on Placeholder, the firm, and then the Solana thesis. And I'm really excited for the projects you backed and kind of see them come out in the world. So I really appreciate your time.
Thanks, Tommy. It's been a pleasure.